entry fee, but I would like to invite you to join the Institute if you have not already done so. The Institute is dependent on the financial support of its members. Membership fees are modest and they are tax deductible. The volunteer on the desk outside tonight would be pleased to take your application for membership after tonight's lecture. Our speaker tonight is Professor Peter Burns of the UBC Faculty of Law. Professor Burns is a native New Zealander who has been at UBC since 1965, and he has served two terms as Dean of the Faculty of Law. His administrative duties as Dean and elsewhere in the university, however, have not deterred him from pursuing his lifelong interest in criminal law, and particularly its international aspects. He's been the chair of the International Center for Criminal Law Reform and Criminal Justice Policy, based at UBC, since 1993. His expertise was recognized when he was appointed a member of the United Nations Organization Committee Against Torture in 1987, a committee with a worldwide mandate and regrettably far too many cases on its agenda. Professor Burns has been the chair of that committee since 1998, and he somehow manages to discharge those onerous responsibilities while maintaining a full-time teaching load at UBC. The work of the committee is his subject tonight. The title of his lecture is The UN Committee Against Torture, From Pinochet to a Borderless World. Professor Burns.
Thank you very much, Mr. Justice McKenzie. I would like to express my appreciation to the Institute for the opportunity to speak to an audience on the work of the Committee Against Torture. I always try to expose what we do to the widest audience I can. It's a somewhat arcane activity, and it's one that very few people are aware of. I would also like to apologize to you all tonight, because I belong to a generation where the idea of a visual aid or a mechanical aid in teaching was a piece of chalk and a library. So tonight, there are not going to be any PowerPoints. There are not going to be any references to equations. I'm afraid it's going to be a very traditional exposition of a specific subject. Now, when the Allied powers created the United Nations Organization following World War II, they had two primary objectives in mind. The first was to create institutions that enhanced international peace and security. And the second was to create processes to establish human rights norms that could be agreed upon as common to all nations. It was thought that by doing the latter, the more difficult goal in the former would be advanced. At an early stage in 1948, the General Assembly, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, delineated the pertinent common human rights. Apart from some specific conventions dealing with fundamentally international criminal conduct, such as the Convention Against Genocide and the Geneva Conventions, seven treaties have been sponsored by the United Nations to implement a universal system of human rights. One of these conventions is the Convention Against Torture. And I propose tonight to focus upon the Convention Against Torture and examine the various effects that it has had in promoting some basic human rights values that in turn indirectly enhance the objective of international peace and security. At the outset, it is useful to describe the way in which human rights systems function in the modern world. At root, there are the state human rights systems, combining statutory schemes with administrative and judicial implementation. In Canada, we have a complex system of federal and provincial human rights commissions, functioning against a backdrop of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. We have statutory schemes and long-developed common law protections. Then there are regional systems, such as those created by the Council of Europe and the Organization of American States. Finally, there is the universal system under the umbrella of the United Nations, of which the Convention Against Torture forms part. In 1984, during the wane of the Cold War, the General Assembly of the United Nations agreed upon the terms of the Convention Against Torture, which became open for any state to adopt. In 1987, the 27th ratification led to it coming into effect. Today, there are 130 state parties. But of the major human rights conventions sponsored by the United Nations, it is the one that is least ratified. And I will return to this somewhat later in my talk. One of the primary aims of the Convention Against Torture, in the words of the senior judge of the English House of Lords, in the celebrated decision of the court in Pinochet Ugarte No. 3, was to provide an international system under which the international criminal, the torturer, would find no safe haven. Tonight, I want to highlight some features of the Convention that I will argue are truly radical, especially in the light of the historical context, the Cold War. As well, I want to direct your attention to some essentially conservative features of the Convention that have had an influence beyond its own reach. Then I want to describe the Pinochet case and reflect upon its significance in the evolving field of international criminal law. Finally, I want to describe the spillover effect of the Convention into the field of refugee claims and its influence upon countries like Canada. We may be here till 1 a.m., but I'm sure you've got the time and the inclination. In order to understand the Convention, there are some fundamental articles in it, and like all conventions, Article 1 is usually the most important. And I want to read to you in full Article 1, which sets out the definition of torture for the purposes of this particular treaty. For the purposes of this convention, the term torture means any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person, or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. It does not include pain or suffering arising only from, inherent in, or incidental to lawful sanctions. You can see, that's assuming you've managed to follow that definition, which is a long and arduous one, you can see that torture is essentially an abuse of power. It is designed to break the will of someone for certain purposes. If the torturing agent is state-sanctioned or even state-related and an appropriate purpose is present, then it is torture as defined by the Convention. You can also see that governments that rely upon coercing its citizens in order to remain in power are unlikely to ratify this convention. That, of course, is the primary reason why only 130 states have actually ratified the convention. The convention requires states to prohibit torture and to compensate and rehabilitate the victims of torture. In order to ensure the implementation of the convention, it creates a committee of 10 persons who have a very specific set of jurisdictions. There is a reporting jurisdiction. The committee receives a report within 2 years
of a state ratifying the convention, and thereafter receives biannual reports. Every 2 years thereafter, we get another report. The reporting function is a function which is common to all the human rights conventions. Yes? No. As I indicated to you earlier, I don't have either the time or the will to write it out by hand, and I don't have a PowerPoint. But I will come back to it, and I will focus on the most important features of it. I knew that long definition was going to cause trouble. We've got academics in the audience. All the human rights treaty bodies created under the Human Rights Conventions are reflected in a committee system, and it's called the Human Rights Reporting System. And it is thought that if a state is forced, initially after 2 years and thereafter periodically, to report to a committee what it has done and is doing to implement the terms of the committee, and if the committee is satisfied that there is a reasonable attempt to actually adapt the internal legislation and judicial and administrative schemes that exist in the state concerned to the obligation set out in the convention, that eventually most states, in fact, will observe the terms of the convention. This is an interesting system. It was not one I was familiar with until I was engaged in it. And it basically means that the committee does not interrogate because it's not described as an interrogation, does not cross-examine because it's not described as a cross-examination. The committee engages in what is described as a dialogue, a constructive dialogue with the state party concerned. In reality, it is a form of cross-examination. And what the committee is attempting to do is to examine the report, see whether or not the report accurately reflects what is going on in the state concerned, and it draws conclusions and makes recommendations. Those conclusions and recommendations go to the General Assembly of the United Nations and are published in the annual report of the committee. And those conclusions and recommendations are utilized usually by non-governmental organizations for the purposes of pressuring governments to observe the terms of the convention. The committee itself doesn't have any sanction that it can impose against the country concerned. It is just the power of persuasion and the political effect of a state party not observing the obligations and being castigated by the committee that the committee has in its armory. The second type of jurisdiction is contained in Article 21, and the committee is, if you like, an arbitrator between two states that are party to the convention, where one state is arguing that the other state is in breach of the convention. Now, this, to my knowledge, has never been utilized, certainly not insofar as the Convention Against Torture is concerned, but to my knowledge has never been utilized with any of the human rights conventions. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist or an economist to figure out why that is so. The reason's very simple. Once one state breaks the unstated rule, you don't call another state to task, then it's open game on all states. They could all be subjected to the same sort of activity, and none of them want that, not even the most holy of states like Canada. Then we have a particular jurisdiction under Article 22. And this relates to what is known in the United Nations as the complaint system or the communication system. If a state ratifies not merely the convention but Article 22 of the convention, then individuals can complain to the committee that the state has broken the convention and caused some injury to the individual.
And this is where our growth end of the business has been emerging over the last 10 or 12 years, particularly with reference to the refugee system. We have in the convention Article 22, which when it is placed in conjunction with Article 3, Article 3, I'll now very briefly summarize it for you. Article 3 says, no state shall return or expel a person to another state where there is, and this is a summary of the actual language, a real risk of harm that they will be tortured. Okay, no state will return or expel a person to another country where there is a real risk of harm that they'll be tortured. Now, of course, you can understand immediately what this means. In those countries that receive refugees and have ratified Article 22, which allows individuals to complain to the committee, if a person has failed within a refugee process to be characterized as a refugee, they can then send effectively a complaint to our committee and say, if I am sent back to my home country, there's a real risk of harm that I will be tortured. Now, given that we only meet twice a year, and given that there is a backlog of cases in any event, that means that almost automatically we ask the state concerned not to send them back until we've had a chance to look at the merits of the case. That means in a country like Canada, where you do have a very active immigration bar, and they're alert to all possibilities, and where you have a very sophisticated refugee system, we get lots of cases. There are a few countries where the same is true. We get cases from Sweden, from Denmark, from Holland, and Australia. And these are the refugee-receiving states. These are the states where there are large numbers of refugees on an ongoing basis. This has caused a great deal of difficulty, not merely for the committee, but for the states concerned, because it means almost automatically the state can't extradite a person or can't send a person back to their home country until we have dealt with the case, and that means that they stay, if it's Canada, in Canada for another 12 months at the expense of the Canadian taxpayer. And that is causing a great deal of angst in not so much Ottawa, but in capitals like Canberra and now in Copenhagen. But I'll come back to that when I deal with immigration matters in specific. The fourth type of jurisdiction is unique to the Convention Against Torture. We have, under Article 20, an investigative jurisdiction. If there is well-founded evidence of systematic torture, we can, with cooperation of the state party concerned, and assuming that the state party is bound by Article 20, and most are, we can engage in an on-the-ground investigation of the situation in that country insofar as torture is concerned. And after that, we can publish our findings or not publish our findings depending on what we find to be the case or whether we think that we can negotiate with the state concerned and improve what is going on. To date, we've published three. At the moment, there are three unpublished investigations and one investigation which is in the process of being examined by the committee. This is a very dramatic intrusion on a state sovereignty. For an outside body to come in and investigate the existence or non-existence of something as both obnoxious and as basic as torture. Because when you think about it, and you think about the definition of torture, the torture takes place in either one of two places. It takes place in the police stations or detention centers or prisons.
Normally it takes place in police stations. Within 48 hours of arrest, 90% of all types of torture occurs. It usually doesn't occur in prisons. But you can just see, if we decide to make an investigation like that, what impact that has on the government concerned. No state wants to be identified with torture as either policy or a failure on their part to properly remediate torture if it occurs without authority. So we've got our four types of jurisdiction. And you can see that given that we've only got 3 weeks in May and 2 weeks in November to deal with all these issues, sometimes we're very hard-pressed to cope with it. Now, I said to you that I thought there were some truly radical effects of the convention. What are they? Well, the first is in Article 2, Paragraph 2. It excludes the defense of necessity as a justification for torture. Necessity is a common law defense. It's available in Canada as a common law defense. Very rare defense, but it does exist. The convention just precludes it. You cannot plead necessity as a basis for committing torture if you are a party to the convention. The illustration, I suppose, that I would give you is the relationship we've had with Israel over the years. Israel has been confronted with an enormously difficult problem. It has a situation whereby Arab terrorists engage in attacks upon the civilian population. If the security forces manage to obtain the person of one of these people and believes that he has information that could prevent an attack upon the civilian population, the dilemma that they're confronted with is, how do we extract that information? And if we fail to extract that information, what is the effect going to be on civilians in this country? Well, the GSR used to engage in a variety of interrogation techniques that fell within what was called the Landau rules of interrogation. Mr. Justice Landau was a judge of the Supreme Court, and he concluded that moderate physical pressure or moderate physical force was tolerable and justifiable in those circumstances. And you can see what the Israeli authorities, per Mr. Justice Landau, are doing. It's only if severe pain or suffering is imposed under the definition of torture in the convention that there is a breach of the convention. And the Israelis took the position that whatever they were doing was not severe, it was moderate. That was a very specifically selected word. The evidence that we had presented to us indicated that moderate physical pressure included methodologies such as urine-soaked rags over the heads and faces of the detainee, loud music ensuring the detainee could not sleep for a period of up to 48 hours, using different modes of confining the detainee in very uncomfortable positions in circumstances where if they moved they may fall from a table to the floor. There was also some indication, although the Israelis always denied this, but we had affidavit evidence to the contrary, that detainees were placed adjacent to air conditioning units so that the cold air would cause considerable pain to them. In any event, we had the first report of the Israelis, and we said, look, we think you've got a problem. In your next report, we want to address it. You know, we want you to go away, come back, tell us whether our spin on this is accurate or whether we've got it wrong. They came back and they basically said, you've still got it wrong. So we became a little firmer and said, we're not satisfied with your report. We want you now to go off and specifically address this problem. And they came back and they said, basically, you've still got it wrong. It was at that point we concluded they were committing torture. It's one of the few occasions that we have actually made that finding against a state under the state reporting system. 18 months later, as a result of the Supreme Court of Israel examining the matter and concluding that according to the common law of Israel, torture could not be subjected to the defense of necessity, the GST changed its working methodology. So I'm pleased to say today, as far as we're aware, the methodologies that were acceptable under the Landau rules are no longer applied by the security forces, as far as we're aware. I'm the chairman, so I assign the cases. I assign the individual cases, and I assign the state party's reports to individual members of the committee to act as rapporteurs on. As a consequence, I tend to get the more difficult ones. And the one I had last November was one that indicates to you that I'm an equal opportunity niggard. And that was with Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia is a Muslim country, but it's a relatively unique one because it adheres to an extraordinarily fundamentalist view of Islam and the Quran, and it takes the Quran quite literally. And they relied on the fact, when they ratified the convention, that the definition of torture had that little rider at the end. Torture does not include pain or suffering, which is just part of the lawful infliction of a sanction. They relied on that, and they said when they came to us, okay, well, we behead people and we flog people, but all we're doing is what we are obliged to do according to the domestic law of Saudi Arabia. And the domestic law of Saudi Arabia is based on the Quran, and you have no business even raising the issue. Well, the word law is capable of more than one definition. I see Professor Copperthorne here, and he knows what I'm talking about, even if I don't. And it could mean international law or domestic law, or it could mean international law and domestic law. And it should come as no surprise to you that the committee interpreted the word law, lawful sanction, to mean according to domestic and international law, whereas the Saudis construed it to mean only domestic law. And we had a very interesting constructive dialogue with the Saudis. I have been, on an ad hominem basis, abused by many ambassadors in the committee. The Chinese ambassador once spent 20 minutes advising me that he thought I didn't understand cultural differences, but the Saudis were rather more direct in their response. And anyway, I don't want you to think that we're sort of focusing on Israel alone. We have focused on other countries as well. Now, another truly radical effect of the convention is the exclusion of the defense of superior orders under Article 2, Paragraph 3. This defense is in existence at customary international law, even though it's very narrow in scope, and is also recognized under the statute of the International Criminal Court pursuant to its Article 33. In Canada, Section 269.13 of the Criminal Code specifically precludes both necessity and superior orders from being raised as a defense to the crime of torture. We have enacted a crime of torture in exactly the same language as Article 1 of the Convention in this country, and we have also, by statute, precluded the defenses of necessity and superior orders. Now, pursuant to Articles 5 to 7 of the Convention, State parties are obliged to assume a universal jurisdiction over torturers in their territory, where there has been no extradition of them. Now, this is an extraordinary and onerous obligation that has not always been fully undertaken or even understood by some state parties. And it was this obligation that stood at the base of the Pinochet hearings. The Criminal Code, Section 269.1, in my view, does not meet the requirements of Article 5 of the Convention. It does not take to itself a universal jurisdiction over torturers in Canada, other than those whose torture amounts also to war crimes or crimes against humanity under Section 7 of the Criminal Code. In my opinion, this is a clear breach of Canada's obligations under the Convention. A third radical feature of the Convention is the importation of torture into existing extradition treaties. As you know, customary international law obliges extradition crimes to be crimes in the requesting state as well as in the requested state. This is known as the doctrine of double criminality. But torture as an independently defined crime pursuant to the Convention is of a very recent origin, whereas there are a multitude of quite old extradition treaties. Pursuant to Article 8 of the Convention, the conduct relating to torture that states are obliged to criminalize in their domestic law is incorporated into existing extradition treaties by reference to the Convention itself. In other words, they are fictionally deemed to be part of all existing extradition treaties. This is another supreme example of how lawyers, by legal fiction, create crimes. The Convention does not merely prohibit torture, it also prohibits cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, which does not amount to torture, and this is pursuant to its Article 16. Now, this conduct is undefined and is heavily fact-specific. Conditions of detention clearly run the risk of clashing with this provision. Now, the United States is a party to the Convention Against Torture. It may well be that the conduct of the United States in imprisoning people in Guantanamo Bay does not amount to torture, but they clearly run a risk of coming into conflict with Article 16. Because it seems to me an argument can be made that it may not be cruel or inhuman, but it may very well be degrading the conditions in which people are being kept there. And although the United States presented its report some 18 months ago, it'll be due to report again in about 2 years, and I have no doubt that a number of questions are going to be raised about the conditions in Guantanamo Bay. Another radical effect is the indirect effect upon refugee determination practices of states' parties. I've already indicated to you that the combined effect of Articles 3 and 22 have an impact on immigration and refugee processes in refugee-receiving states. There are presently 51 state parties that have acceded to the personal communications jurisdiction of the Committee Against Torture. So, theoretically, any number but at least 51 different states have given the committee the authority to make determinations that will have spillover effects on their immigration determination procedure. Now, as Hart and Negri in their recent work, Empire, posited, the boundaries of nation states have largely become irrelevant as a result of empire's advance, empire being globalized commerce. Their declining sovereignty and their increasing inability to regulate economic and cultural exchanges is reflected not only in globalized commerce, but I would suggest by the United Nations and the international human rights movements themselves. The United Nations, because states have delegated much of their sovereignty to the UN, and the international human rights movements because of the political effect that they have within the states themselves. Against this backdrop, A number of acts in an encompassing morality play are being staged for a worldwide audience. And one of these portrays the human need for security and social betterment. It describes the migration of job seekers from Eastern to Western Europe, the movement of Turks to Germany, Chinese and South Asians to North America, and the dispersion of the oppressed from wherever to anywhere that may provide a safer and economically more opportune haven. This compelling human drama reveals that the combination of raw need with organized crime and terrorist groups that are now truly international in their scope, and where the lines between some governments and some organized crime and terrorist groups have become so blurred as to be almost meaningless, together with modern systems of transport and communication, has rendered traditional borders largely ineffective. Fortress America has become Maginot America. In this context, states attempt to regulate immigration and to provide safe haven to true refugees. Such schemes as are implemented are porous at best, and our news media is replete with instances of illegal entry into Canada by people seeking a better economic future or an escape from justice or injustice in their national home place. The duty of Canada, of course, is to provide a safe haven for genuine refugees, defined as such in Article 1 of the United Nations Convention on the Status of Refugees, which has been adopted by this country. But pursuant to Article 33, the duty of non-return or expulsion does not apply where there are reasonable grounds for regarding a refugee to be a danger to the security of Canada, or who, having been convicted of a final judgment of a particularly serious crime, constitutes a danger to the community of Canada. This is where the potential for conflict between our obligations under the Refugees Convention and the Convention Against Torture arises. And the lines were drawn in a case that was decided by the Supreme Court of Canada this year. In Suresh versus Canada, the appellant was thought to be a member of the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka, one of the most violent terrorist organizations extant. He was considered by the Canadian authorities to be a convention refugee, but that they could authorize his return to Sri Lanka pursuant to Article 33 of the Refugee Convention. In their view, his continued presence here was a danger to Canada's national security. He was ordered to be deported, and this order was upheld by the federal court at both the trial division and court of appeal levels. Given the treatment that the Sri Lankan military authorities had historically dealt to Tamil Tigers, a strong case could be made that someone in Suresh's shoes ran a real risk of torture upon being returned to that country. In the Supreme Court of Canada, the apparent conflict between Article 3 of the Torture Convention and Article 33 of the Refugee Convention was, unlike the Federal Court of Appeal, resolved in favor of the primacy of the principle in the Convention Against Torture, on both charter grounds and in terms of Canada's international legal obligations. Thus, the Minister of Immigration today must consider the risk of torture to an expellee if the facts reasonably raise the issue, and must not expel such a person if he or she is persuaded that there is a real or reasonable risk of torture upon expulsion. Thus, Canada, per this unanimous decision of the Supreme Court of Canada, is now seated on the side of the angels. In other words, since we're now observing what the Committee Against Torture thinks we should, that's my opinion. We're on the right side up in the clouds. The investigative jurisdiction under Article 20 is also very radical. The committee has a unique jurisdiction of inquiry if it receives reliable information revealing well-founded indications of systematic torture. The cooperation of the state party must be sought, and the committee may report its findings in its annual report. It is a confidential process, and to date, 3 reports have been published, and there are several as yet unpublished. I spent a couple of weeks over the summer moving around police stations, detention centers, and prisons in the Balkans. And it's not the way I would normally want to spend the summer. Okay, there are a couple of truly conservative features about the convention. The Convention on Torture in Article 1, I'm sorry, the definition of torture in Article 1 is narrow in two respects. First of all, it is purpose-specific. And secondly, it is confined to conduct related to state agency or state-like agency. Unless you can demonstrate that the conduct was conduct of an employee of the state or someone acting under the authority of the state, the definition doesn't apply. And it's not enough to do that. You must demonstrate they did it for one of the specific purposes referred to in the definition itself, or at least an analogous purpose, if such an analogous purpose can be demonstrated. If you have a look, for example, at the statute of the International Criminal Court, you'll see that at least linguistically, the definition of torture is not so limited. On the other hand, one single instance of torture will suffice to kick in the jurisdiction of the Committee Against Torture, whereas the International Criminal Court requires the conduct to be widespread or systematic. As well, the International Criminal Court requires the conduct to be directed at a civilian population, a requirement that does not constrain the jurisdiction of the Committee Against Torture. So, in the situation where you have an armed conflict, torture may constitute a war crime, but it will also constitute a breach of the convention. So, theoretically at least, the committee would have jurisdiction to deal with it if there was no body that was available to deal with it as a war crime. I want to turn now to the Pinochet case and indicate to you why I think it is so important in ensuring that a tendency that had begun some 10 years earlier picked up steam and led to a result which can only be regarded as a desirable result in diminishing impunity for international criminal conduct. Now, you'll recall that General Pinochet, or Senator Pinochet, depending on how you prefer to refer to him, was the president of Chile, having assumed power during an unlawful putsch. As a result, large numbers of Chileans and foreigners were rounded up, interrogated, strenuously interrogated. Many were killed, many were tortured, many just disappeared. Many years later, a judge in Spain, exercising a jurisdiction which is known as the passive personality jurisdiction, it merely means that if a state recognizes that particular jurisdiction for exercising criminal authority over incidents, that it will extend it to those incidents that have victimized their nationals. And there were many Spanish nationals who had been rounded up, tortured, and executed during the putsch of General Pinochet. Well, examining Magistrate Garzan issued an international arrest warrant against Pinochet, who was then in England for medical treatment. A stipendiary magistrate in London issued a provisional arrest warrant, and then another international arrest warrant, again from Magistrate Garzan, was issued relating to three cases of torture, all of which occurred after the UK had ratified the Convention Against Torture. And again, another arrest warrant was issued by a London magistrate. There was an application made to the district court to quash the warrants, and the application was successful. There was an appeal from that successful application to the House of Lords. And in the House of Lords, by a 3-2 majority, that decision to quash was set aside. And then there was a further appeal to the House of Lords on the grounds that the original decision of the House of Lords was made by a court whereby one member was apparently biased against one of the parties. The point being that one of the judges was an officer in a charity that supported Amnesty International, and his wife had been employed by Amnesty International, and Amnesty International had intervened and was a party in the proceedings. The other members of the House took the view that there was apparent bias on this basis and quashed the decision of the earlier House of Lords. It then went to the House of Lords again, and in this instance, by a margin of 6-1, the House of Lords upheld the second arrest warrant upon the ground that UK courts had a universal jurisdiction over torturers in its territory as a result of the incorporation of the Convention Against Torture into domestic law, and it also held that former heads of state are not immune from prosecution, and that torture is an international crime at customary international law, independently of its status under the Convention. Thus, Pinochet was extraditable, and even though only 3 allegations of torture remained in the arrest warrant after the date of incorporation of the Convention Against Torture into British law, these suffice to support an extradition hearing. Such a hearing took place. Pinochet was ordered to be extradited, and the matter went to the Home Secretary, who concluded that Pinochet was too physically ill to stand trial and declined to order extradition. Pinochet left for Chile, and his immunity from prosecution by the Parliament and confirmed by the Supreme Court. This, of course, must have been a matter that ensured that both the British government and the Spanish government collectively heaved a sigh of relief that the matter was off their table and was shipped back down to Chile. Neither the British government nor the Spanish government really wanted to have anything to do with it. But it also reveals that where you have dedicated individuals with independent powers like Judge Garzon, sometimes governments are forced to confront the issues they should confront, but without having their feet put to the fire, they refuse to do so. In any event, Pinochet was now back in Chile, and the Chilean Parliament stripped him of his former immunity as a senator. And a judge, I guess, who would be the equivalent in Chile of Judge Garzon, this time it's Judge Guzman, started proceedings to prosecute Mr. Pinochet, as he now was called, and he based it on the disappearances of a large number of people during the Pinochet regime. And it was argued by Pinochet, look, there was a punto final. I was a senator, and the Senate passed a piece of legislation that gave me a complete immunity from prosecution for a number of offenses. Kidnappings were one of them. But Judge Guzman had an interesting response. He said, these kidnappings involve disappearances, and these kidnappings are not kidnappings that occur on day one when somebody disappears. These people have continued to be disappeared. And so, as of today, they're still disappeared. It's an ongoing offense. It's not an offense that starts and finishes on a particular day or time. So, you do not have the protection of the punto final. And that certainly carried the day in the judicial system in Chile.
The upshot is, of course, as you probably are all aware, that in fact the Supreme Court of Chile last July concluded that Mr. Pinochet, surprise, surprise, was mentally incompetent and not capable of standing his trial. So Pinochet will never be brought before a court. But I don't think that is the truly significant feature of what has happened. What has happened is, for the first time, the House of Lords recognized a former head of state could be prosecuted in domestic courts. That was an incredible advance on the pre-existing state of law. And of course, it's not just heads of state. It's also ministers of state. It's also ambassadors given certain conditions present. It's a very, very dramatic decision. Now, this year, everything, oddly enough, is a question of timing. And this year, the International Court of Justice, which has not been noted for dramatic decisions in the fields of international human rights, in a case involving Belgium and the Congo, was confronted with an international arrest warrant that had been issued by a Belgian court against a former foreign minister of the Congo. At the time, he was the foreign minister. And the question arose whether or not such a warrant was valid or should it be quashed. The International Court of Justice concluded that that particular warrant should be quashed because customary international law provided an immunity from prosecution in criminal cases of an incumbent head of state or foreign minister. But once they lose their incumbency, then they can be prosecuted. And the ruling also indicated that this applied only to prosecutions before the domestic courts of a state and did not extend to prosecutions before international tribunals. So it would not protect an incumbent from prosecution before the International Criminal Court, just as it wouldn't before the International Tribunal for Rwanda or the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia. So, Mr. Milosevic, of course, is a classic illustration. He's got two things going against him procedurally in terms of jurisdiction. A, he's a former head of state, so the ordinary rule now applies, but he's also being tried before an international tribunal. So even under the ruling of Belgium and the Congo, he would be triable by an international tribunal. The International Court of Justice also said that if the domestic law of a particular state of which a head of state is a national enables domestic prosecution, that too would create an exception to the general rule. But what it really means is once a dictator loses his or her position of power and authority, then they lose everything. They can be prosecuted domestically or internationally. They can be prosecuted sideways, upwards or downwards. So the combined effect of the Convention Against Torture, as applied by the House of Lords and the Congo versus Belgium, is to advance considerably the range of individual international criminal responsibility, and to equally diminish the traditional impunity that formerly pertained. Together with the creation of the International Criminal Court, these decisions place dictators on notice. The Côte d'Azur is no longer a haven for genocidists. Now I want to draw a couple of conclusions. The Convention Against Torture is a significant part of two developments in the post-World War II world. It is part of the universal human rights system that is designed under the auspices of the United Nations to lay down the basic human rights norms applicable to all states. This system also is designed to ensure transparency in implementation of these norms. As well, the convention is tangible evidence of the world community's commitment to abolishing impunity for the commission of international crimes, one of which is torture. Whereas the Genocide and Geneva Conventions were steps upon the way to this goal, they did not provide for any internal oversight mechanism to ensure compliance by states. The Convention Against Torture, on the other hand, has created the committee which is charged with that responsibility. The Convention Against Torture, through its committee, together with the war crimes tribunals for former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and the International Criminal Court, do, I suggest, provide a coherent and comprehensive institutional framework for reaching the objective of negating impunity for the worst international crimes. All that is also required is the will of the world community to actually comply with their obligations under the instruments setting up these institutions. The Convention Against Torture, through its committee structure, provides an essential burr under the saddle of state complacency. A small burr, perhaps, but one that cannot be ignored in the light of domestic political effects of criticism by the committee. Finally, the worst judges of the effectiveness of any undertaking are those engaged in it at the time. There is an inbuilt tendency to rationalize failures and to exaggerate successes. Accordingly, I leave it to historians who are able to dispassionately analyze the social results of the Convention Against Torture. But as one who is engaged in the Convention's processes, and upon the basis of imperfect observation and intuition, I am convinced that the world is a better place for its implementation. Thank you for your patience. Question is, when the initial determination under our immigration processes reveal that the immigration authorities do not think that there is a real risk of torture if a person is expelled, can at that stage someone go directly to the committee? Short answer is no. You must exhaust all your domestic remedies. It's a standard provision in international law. So you're going to have to go through the whole process of asking for review in the Federal Trial Court, Court of Appeal, ultimately Supreme Court of Canada, then ultimately discretion of the minister. Three questions have been asked. Why didn't Britain and Spain, in my view, really want, A, in Britain's case, to extradite to Spain, Mr. Pinochet, and in Spain's place, to prosecute him criminally, and B, is Dr. Henry Kissinger guilty of war crimes or torture? I should say, and see how would I analyze the fact patterns relating to Mr. Kissinger in order to reach a conclusion. Okay, I'll deal with the first two first and tell you I won't answer that question. I'm not going to indicate whether I think Dr. Kissinger is guilty of torture. I just don't have any information. But I will answer the first, and it's really my own take on it. When you're dealing with figures like heads of state, you cannot in any way remove politics from the equation. You can't remove politics from any extradition equation because ultimately a political figure makes the decision to extradite or not extradite. In England's case, it was the Home Secretary, a member of cabinet. Now, think about it for a moment. The Spanish government has good relations currently with Chile. It has much Spanish capital invested in Chile. The last thing in the world the Spanish government wants to do is to engage in any activity that might be seen to be an attempt to erode Chile's own sovereignty. That is to say, to prosecute or not prosecute for crimes that occurred on Chilean territory. I think the Spanish position is perfectly comprehensible. Judge Garzon, on the other hand, is a guy who marches to his own drummer. And examining magistrates under the continental system have a jurisdiction that our magistrates do not have, that investigative jurisdiction, which is not controllable by the authorities. He was exercising his jurisdiction quite properly. So I think that's the real reason why Spain was not very pleased. Britain? Well, Britain's on the sidelines. You think about its situation for a moment. Who was it who assisted Britain in the Falkland War? It was General Pinochet. Pinochet made his resources available to Britain. Information, particularly security intelligence information, was passed through Pinochet's government or his offices to the British during that war. And what have the British got in the sidelines watching all this? Someone that they would hate to have biting at their heels, even if they're a Labour government, and that's Mrs. Thatcher. She was the one, don't forget, that had this very strong view of the assistance Britain had received from General Pinochet. But apart from that, Britain also has a lot of investment in Chile. And again, they don't want the Chilean government mad at them because it appears that Britain is intervening to somehow erode their jurisdiction, their sovereignty. But it's worse than that. I mean, this is their president. Even although he may not be the current government's president, quote-unquote, he's still a Chilean. And we do tend to wrap ourselves up in our flags, our national flags, when these things occur. So Britain would have just, I'm sure, I've never asked anybody there, but my own take on it is Britain would just have loved the thing to go away. And, you know, you look at it, the Home Secretary who has the ultimate decision gets three British medical experts who all come to the same conclusion. He's physically incapable. I don't know. Question is, why should anybody be immune for the commission of an international crime like genocide, torture, war crimes, crimes against humanity? It's a given in international relations that comity, that is to say, respect for institutions and respect for the conduct of legally structured institutions is essential for a civilized intercourse in the international sphere. And once you permit a sitting president to be dragged before the domestic courts of another country, you create not only a dislocation of diplomatic relations, you create all sorts of possibilities for conflict, real conflict, and that is not something that, as a matter of comity, international law wants to accommodate. Now, you'll notice that as a result of the decisions of the International Court of Justice in relation to the House of Lords, it's only sitting heads of state and sitting foreign ministers who are now given the immunity. There's a slight dislocation with ambassadors, but put them to one side. Once they lose their authority, then the policy that protects them whilst they are incumbents no longer exists, and they've lost it. And I teach international criminal law, and I'm an advocate for much stronger rules of recognition of international criminality and the reduction of immunity. But I have to admit that there are reasons that at least sound reasonable to me for retaining that limited immunity. I may not be persuaded personally, but there's a strong body of opinion that thinks it should be retained. And the International Court of Justice did too. I think this is a comment. General Massou in Algeria was a man of high moral principle and resisted pressure from his subordinates to allow torture in the battle with the Algerian insurrectionists, and then ultimately gave in for pragmatic reasons. But before doing so, in order to demonstrate his high moral principles, had the torture applied to himself. I'm not quite sure how that works, but I don't know whether that's true. I have absolutely no idea. And all I can say is if it happened today, it wouldn't protect him. It might involve, however, if it happened domestically in this jurisdiction, an order of the court to hold him on remand for some mental examination.
Got another question there. What's the point of considering the application of the committee or the charter with respect to the abolition of capital punishment in America? Is there much room in the second element of the definition to expand its scope?
We have never had to confront, the question is, what about capital punishment? How does it apply? No one has really argued that capital punishment is prohibited under the definition of torture. And I think it would be a mistake strategically for anyone to do that. If I were going to make the argument, I would make the argument that under Article 16, prohibiting cruel, degrading, and inhumane treatment or punishment, it's prohibited. So, no, it has never come up, and you've got to be a realist. It could come up, and I'm not sure, quite frankly, which way the committee would divide on that. We have representatives from Egypt, from China, from Russia, inter alia, and from the United States on the committee. And as a pragmatist, I'm happier that it's not being dealt with at the moment. The only thing I would say is that my personal view is that you're going to have a very hard job at this stage persuading someone like me that at customary international law at this very moment, it's prohibited. But the minute you're able to demonstrate that, I have absolutely no doubt we will swing the committee, even if there are some dissensions. Question is, and it's not confined to that, you're really asking what sort of sanctions we have, period. Well, that, you know, that's any country, quite frankly, because the United States is at least a democracy that listens to you, doesn't reject out of hand what you're saying, it may ignore it subsequently, but there are some countries that don't listen to you. We do not have sanctioning power in the same way that a court has. We are not a court. We're not even an administrative tribunal because we cannot issue orders. We do not issue orders. We make recommendations. Now, the sanctioning effect of the recommendations is essentially political. If we are making a recommendation which by implication indicates that a state is committing torture, that's extremely strong, even in the General Assembly. But where you get your real muscle is from the human rights organizations in the country concerned. Amnesty International is everywhere. Human Rights Watch is everywhere. Most countries have their own domestic human rights interested groups. And they will take that, and they will go to their press, and they will go to their media, and they will start holding their government's feet to the flames. And that, ultimately, I think, is the sanction that we have. We have more of, if you like, I think we have more of a sanction in Europe than we have in North America. For example, the media actually report what we're doing in Europe. But you will hardly ever see anything in the media in North America. But the local amnesty groups know what we're doing. The local immigration lawyers know what we're doing. The local human watch groups know what we're doing. And I think we can rely on them to use it the way it ought to be used. They're very sophisticated. Right. Well, in my own case, it's a mystery. Yeah. How are the members of the committee of 10 persons selected, and how long do they serve? Seriously, in my own case, it was a mystery. I just got a call from Foreign Affairs one day asking me if I would let my name go forward. It's a voting process. The states, first of all, states who are state parties must nominate. So you get over that hurdle. Then the nominees go to a meeting of the state's parties. Not physically, your names and curricula vitae do. and the states' parties vote on who the members of the committee will be. And you're up for re-election every 4 years. Now, I'm the only member of the committee that has been there from day one. So if the committee's activities have all sorts of deficiencies and failures, I'm responsible. But if they have been effective, probably in some small measure I've been responsible as well. I have offended a large number of states in the last 3 years. And I'm not sure whether I will get reelected if Canada chooses to nominate me. The question is, given the definition in Article 1 of torture, would the committee consider whether or not the people held in Guantanamo Bay are being subjected to torture? Well, the short answer is we'll always consider it. If an issue is raised before us, we'll consider it. But I think it's unlikely with Guantanamo Bay. There's just no evidence of the sort of conduct that falls within the definition of torture. Severe pain or suffering. That's the key to that. If you demonstrate to us that there is severe pain or suffering, or if there's evidence of severe pain or suffering, that would raise it for us. But as I understand it, it's really the conditions under which they're being held that is subject to concern at the moment. And that's why I think it's more likely to be a breach of Article 16 rather than a breach of Article 1 that is going to attract the attention of the committee at the next meeting with the United States. Oh, sure. But it's got to be severe pain or suffering. And it can be mental or physical. Yeah. Okay. Initially, you mean under Article 3, obviously. Yeah. Okay, initially, this question was, what is the standard of proof? You see, only a common lawyer would ask this sort of question, or only a group of lawyers would even be interested in this particular issue. But the question is, what is the standard of proof pursuant to Article 3 in determining whether or not there's a real risk of harm? Well, we've actually issued our only general comment dealing with this specific issue. And we have concluded that a real risk of harm requires the applicant to demonstrate at a prima facie level that there is such a real risk. This means that it has to go beyond mere speculation, but it does not have to amount to a probability. The United States had tried, when it ratified the convention, as a reservation to ratification, to put itself in a position of only being subjected to our jurisdiction if it went beyond a probability. Well, we reject that. Under its Article 22 jurisdiction, it can only take it under advisement if it is sent to it. Okay, that's the communication system. We can, however, self-generate
our investigations under Article 20, and we do. We also, I might add, having generated an investigation, self-degenerate, conclude we were wrong. We've done that too. Well, I'm not willing to tell you, because I'm still a sitting member of the committee, what I would do, but that issue was raised by the committee at the last meeting with Canada about 10 months ago, specifically, and I don't sit on any interaction with the committee if Canada is the country. So I sit and bite my tongue listening to this discussion. But that was a specific question that was asked, and I'm sure it's going to be asked again of the Canadian government. Individual members of the Aboriginal community are perfectly entitled, for example, relatives of people who have been killed. It was Saskatchewan, wasn't it? In Saskatchewan, as a result of this alleged behavior of police officers. If they do not get satisfaction within Canada, can use the Article 22 jurisdiction, but they've got to exhaust the domestic remedies first. I can tell you how the committee would deal with it, with the back of its hand. Because the convention says so. It precludes it. Well, you take it up with the drafters. I think not, and I'll tell you why. Where those of us, even like me on the periphery, who are engaged in all these processes and things occurring to create institutions at the moment, want to have a comprehensive system to prohibit international crime and to punish international criminals. The way the International Criminal Court is structured, its jurisdiction is confined to torture which constitutes a war crime or a crime against humanity. And a crime against humanity requires it to be systematic or widespread, whereas we have jurisdiction over individual acts of torture. It doesn't have to be widespread. We also have jurisdiction, which the International Criminal Court does not, over non-civilian population-directed torture. And for that reason, we fill that gap. That's, I guess, the answer I would give. At the moment, unless you expand the jurisdiction of the ICC, we fill that gap. I would love to see the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court expanded. What it may mean is that our Article 20 jurisdiction becomes relatively meaningless because it's confined to systematic torture. And one of the types of torture over which the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction is systematic torture, as defined.
On the other hand, we're in active investigative pursuit on an ongoing basis, and the International Criminal Court, I believe, will be starved of resources. It may well be that you want to have these two institutions plugging alongside each other so long as they don't trip up against each other. Alec, I'm not sure what you mean by Elsterman. What?
Good cop, bad cop.
Oh, good cop, bad cop. The question is whether or not good cop, bad cop interrogations are still permitted. Of course they are. Doesn't affect those. All that Justice Landau said was security forces could, and it was confined only to where they have possession of persons that they believe are terrorists themselves and have information about an impending attack upon a civilian target. Only there could you apply moderate physical pressure. So it doesn't affect the standard methods of interrogation. Dershowitz. Yeah. Well, I could comment. Alan Dershowitz, who is a professor in the United States and a very prominent attorney, criminal defense attorney, took the view that perhaps the United States in its fight against terrorism should acknowledge that it has the capacity and should exercise the will to torture terrorist suspects in order to obtain information, rather like the Israeli government, to prevent further terrorist activities. I don't know whether Dershowitz was just being provocative. I have a feeling he might have been. On the other hand, I don't know the guy, so whether he has a sense of humor or not, I don't know. But that was, in my view, as someone that has to apply the Convention Against Torture, outrageous. But at the same time, as I recall, was there not also a member of the U.S. cabinet who made a slightly similar comment? So perhaps at that time it was a view that was being bruited around among policymakers in the United States, and he was just floating the idea to see whether or not it would be acceptable in a wider area. Clearly it would be in contravention of the convention. There was just no question about that. And I am very pleased to say it was not taken up and pushed. Well, you know, my reaction is, of course, it's outrageous. And I, however, look at consequences. And although the media may not have been editorials, blah, 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 it has gone nowhere, to my knowledge. And I think that's where it should stay.
Professor Elizabeth Ettinger, the Associate Dean of the Faculty of Law.
to thank our speaker.
It's relatively easy to draft a fine document guaranteeing certain rights and prohibiting certain conduct. It's the implementation and the enforcement of that fine document that is so difficult. I think it's not intuitive that a committee would be the tool selected to enforce a convention against torture. At least that was my thought when I learned that Professor Burns had been appointed to the committee, but I'm quite a bit of a cynic, actually. I long ago decided that my cynicism had been misplaced because Professor Burns continued to serve on the committee, and I believe that he is not a person that would be wasting his time on a committee that accomplishes nothing. Tonight, we have been treated to a clear and lively exposition of the jurisdiction and the operations of the committee and of some recent judicial activity implementing the convention as well. On behalf of all of us here, I would like to thank Professor Burns for both serving on the committee and sharing his experience with us.